thing that crossed my mind and then it sort of left at the time.
Never happened.
Yeah. Well, let's just wait a couple minutes and let me get some,
okay,
some more bearings on this.
In the meantime, we haven't heard anything about your siblings.
So I will do that, sure. Okay.
Okay.
But I'm still on,
okay,
my predecessors. I sort of wanted to stay with one group at a time and see if then we can move into that.
Okay.
It just something just crossed my mind. Oh, you have it on now.
Yeah. That's okay.
Okay.
You were talking about how your uncle, or how the residents.
I want to talk. Yes, there's something else that I wanted to go into, and that's, that I thought has historic importance from the point of view of our specific roles in the Keysport. Of course, they came here, my family came here in 1907 and then in 1908. I don't know when my grandmother came. All the Jews then in the Keysport lived in an area, I say all, at least all the ones I know about, lived in an area called Mulberry Alley. And Mulberry Alley was lower, was called the first ward of McKeesport. And even as I grew up as a youngster, that's where the synagogues were, that's where the old-timers still lived. That no longer exists. They tore that all down. Naturally, as always happens, the Jews moved up on the hill to more affluent lodgings, and we did the same. First we moved to an area called Christie Park, and then later we moved to an area called Meyer Park, which was then more luxurious in its appearance and better schools, so to speak. But at any rate, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the war. We became involved, the United States became involved in the war in 1917. My uncle, who I referred to many times, and his first cousin, Jake Pildish, were conscientious objectors during the war. And that was part of their background in Russia, where they were socialists. And part of the socialist dogma, so I'm taught, had to do with opposing wars. And as such, they both entered into the Quartermaster Corps. And I have seen, I don't think I have in my possession, photographs of them made in those army uniforms at that time in the Quartermaster Corps. My father, however, was too young to be drafted at that time because he was already a married man, and he had the first child, who was born in 1918, my only sibling, my sister, whose name is Adelaide. Adelaide was considered probably the most beautiful child in McKeesport, and her looks were actually legendary. She now lives in Cleveland, has lived there for many years, married into the Farkas family, a Hungarian family from the Keysport, Hungarian Jewish family from the Keysport. Her husband is Gilbert Farkas. He's now about 80 years old, I think maybe 82. And we see them often, we're very close. They have two sons. One named Bruce, who lives in Cleveland and is in the sign-making business, and another son who lives in Washington, D.C., who is a very successful consultant. Don't ask me to explain what a consultant does. As a neurosurgeon, I do many consultations, but I know I never made the money that he makes. So there's something special about consultations that he does. I think he, for instance, PPG had him here, and he does consultating about how to revise, or maybe Howard, you know this, coming from Westinghouse, to tell them how to set up their administration in a different way to save money and be more efficient. And how he comes to this knowledge, I don't know. He's an interesting young man in the fact that he went through high school in Cleveland, and he was the president of his class every year from the time he was in first grade through high school. Became in his senior year the all high school president of Cleveland, and subsequent to that became the all Ohio class president of high schools. Yes, imagine that. So he's a very handsome and interesting young man. He's married, very successfully married, a lovely wife, and they have a lovely home in Washington. We're very close to them. My sister went to the University of Pittsburgh, became a school teacher, actually taught shorthand, became a proficient shorthand expert, and then married Gil Farkas, and because of his work, that took him to Cleveland, where they lived shortly after their marriage.
Your other, were you and your
sister?
Yeah, just two of us.
Yeah, why don't you go on with yourself?
Okay.
How'd you and Sidell get together?
Well, let's talk about his education and,
in what order? Yes, okay.
And your teachers, any special teachers, or,
well, let's talk, yes, okay. I started to mention, one Egon Pessin.
What?
Egon Pessin.
Oh, right, yeah.
Egon Pessin was a unique individual who came to McKeesport from Germany. He took over and managed the Temple B'nai Israel in McKeesport. And my mother, who was a very intelligent woman, became a Sunday school teacher. And so we were particularly close to him. McKeesport, this Temple B'nai Israel never really had a rabbi. Now, he was educated as a rabbi, but never had become ordained and really considered himself a cantor. And the reason is because he always wanted to be a singer. And he came from Germany, I don't know what town in Germany, but he wanted to come here for the purpose of getting into the Metropolitan Opera. And he actually, before he came and ended up in McKeesport, he actually did sing in the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera. How it turned out that we got him in McKeesport, I don't know, but it turned out he was a very unusual man. He loved children. He never married. He devoted his entire being and his entire life to this temple in McKeesport. And as such, became very meaningful to me because, as I said earlier, he filled a certain emptiness in my existence because of the death of my father. He not only taught the young people, but he also supervised the teaching that was done by others. And he made the temple in McKeesport, this Temple B'nai Israel, a Jewish community center. And it provided opportunities. Now, of course, the Hungarians were not involved in this at all. They had their own outlets and their own places of study, Jewish study and Jewish affiliation. But for those who were not Hungarians and who were more modern in their approach, the Temple B'nai Israel became the center of Jewish activity. We, as youngsters, would appear there almost every day of the week after school, after regular school. And that included coming directly from school to the temple, where in the winter time we played basketball. There was some sort of a gymnasium, as we call it. It was much too low ceiling to be a real gymnasium, but nonetheless, to us, it was all we had, and we all played basketball. We had Boy Scouts there, and one day a week we met as Boy Scouts, and two or three days a week we met for Hebrew classes, and one day a week we met for Sunday classes, and Friday night we met for Friday night services, and Saturday morning we met for Saturday morning services, and after we were bar mitzvahed, then every morning we appeared at 7 o'clock before we went to school for a minyan, to provide a minyan. We had to do that for 4 years, following which they gave us a watch. Interestingly, I still have that watch. It doesn't run, but it's inscribed in the back. And so this was the kind of centralization of Jewish activity that was so meaningful. He provided this kind of stimulus. For example, every year we gave a play, sometimes twice a year. All the holidays were celebrated in some fashion at this synagogue. It was the major focus of Jewish activity for those of us who were members. However, money was always, as is, I guess, everywhere, was during the Depression, during my youth, a major problem. And I can remember that this Mr. Pessin not only never was paid for his work, but also went door to door collecting money to keep the place running, to pay the light bills and the heating bills and so forth. The teachers did not get paid. They had a secretary, I remember, and she probably drew a little bit of a salary. Her name was Chotner. The Chotners were very involved. My brother-in-law's sister, Harriet, was very involved as a teacher and as a secretary. And it was like an extended family relationship. The attitude that we all had a central interest. I remember that I became a Boy Scout there. He was very active and before that telephone call, we're talking about the importance.
Pessin. Extended family.
Extended family relationships that existed. That was a unique experience because we don't think now. I think young people today don't realize how much anti-Semitism we faced in those days. Nothing was open to us otherwise. Young people now assimilate, 50% intermarriage rate, we know about that among college students. Everybody went to college. As a matter of fact, in 1940, which was when I started college, only 4% of America had been to college. Of citizens of the United States. So this is an entirely different world. Listen, we're talking about the era in which what was the name of the ship came from Europe in 1938 and was turned back with 900 Jewish refugees from Germany, and nobody raised a finger to save those people who managed to get out of Europe. It was a different era. That would not happen today. But also, we were much more isolated as a Jewish community. There were many fewer opportunities for us to participate in citywide activities. But during those Depression years, there were also good aspects because it provided for us a certain kind of education and interdependency as Jews on one another, and I think was probably why I, for instance, and many like me, became really involved in Jewish affairs and continued to maintain that interest, because in many small towns in western Pennsylvania, this was essentially the pattern of life and pattern of behavior. Let's see, what else can I tell you about that background? Sport.
Brad, I think it's interesting about the life in those times and how it was different.
Than today. Yes, certainly.
Especially with the Jews and.
Do you call one anti-Semitic event you personally experienced?
Well, surprisingly, Harry, that's a question I never. Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I never really could. You know, you never could prove these things. But you just accepted that you were different. There was something, some aspect of it. And an example that I always remember was when I was in eighth grade at a school called George Washington School, and I don't think I've told this to anybody. I remember being called to the principal's office at the beginning of eighth grade. We didn't have junior high school. We went from eighth grade to high school. And I had been what's called a patrolman, a school patrol. And I remember the principal's name was McElroy. I remember him very well. And even though I had been class president and had been editor of the newspaper, the school newspaper, it came down to meeting in the principal's office for our patrol assignments. And I remember, without by your leave or how do you do or goodbye or go to hell, he said, "Jimmy Hammer, you're going to be the captain." And I knew then, I understood then, that that was not for me, that there was a difference about Jimmy Hammer. He was a very nice young man, nothing bad. I remember him very well. But he was sort of an inactive, kind of passive individual, probably never dreamed of anything more than being a school patrolman. I don't know what's happened to him. But I knew, or I had those feelings.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. We did have some very nice teachers, and I remember teachers from those years who were very meaningful to me. My mother always participated with the teachers. She always invited the teachers over, and she would have a card party every once in a while, and the teachers always participated in that card party. And my mother was very progressive and very alert and aware of her role, because she worked. My father died, as we said, at the beginning of the Depression. Our business went to the devil. It was not very long after that that it was closed up entirely. My Uncle Phil, who I loved dearly, was bankrupt, and my mother was left to go on her own. When the father dies at age 32, you don't think much about insurance or having any provisions. And she worked, and I have a recollection that her first job, she made $79 a month. And I guess at that time, Roosevelt became very important to me at that time, because Roosevelt represented, again, as a young fellow being, it's interesting, people are not aware what it means to be brought up without a father. But other areas seem to draw your interest. I remember, for example, in 1936, if you know the story of the legislation that was passed in Congress in those years of the first Roosevelt administration, they passed a bill called the Home Owners Loan Corporation. And I remember as a child, and how old could I have been? I was probably 1936, I was 13 years old. I remember how important, how significant that was to me, because up until that point, there was always the question of whether we could pay the mortgage. And from that point forward, we apparently, and I don't even remember the details of that, but what a change that made, the fact that we didn't have to worry about that anymore. Those kinds of significant acts in the Depression were very meaningful to young people, how the Depression played an impressionistic role in forming your concerns about life, and also devotion to the concepts of the New Deal at that time. So I became interested in politics, I think, then, and I became interested in the fact that my uncle, who was a lawyer, then moved in with us and lived with us, and I remember that he moved in with us when he just graduated from law school. So that was, as a matter of fact, as he always told me, that he came from graduation to my father's funeral. It's interesting that the concepts of how we talked about families helping each other. My uncle, who was the youngest child of the Kessler family, went to high school, college, and law school by the help from my father and my Uncle Phil. And there was no question, and my uncle always related, he lived with my Uncle Phil during his college and law school years, and he always related how my uncle saw to it that he was the only one in the family that had his own room and had total privacy so that he could study. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
How different things were in those days. How they realized how important it was to get an education. Those kinds of stories were always very meaningful to me. And then, of course, when there was room in our house, we had a house, and my father died, and it was just my sister, myself, and my mother. So he moved in and lived with us. And it was that was in 1930. And in 1930, I think it was 38 or 39, my mother moved to Pittsburgh. The reason that she moved, I'm not sure. I think it's because she had a job. Yes, she was commuting back and forth to Pittsburgh. And she had a job and worked for the some government agency. I think it was the unemployment agency in downtown Pittsburgh, and would commute on the train every day, as a lot of McKeesport people did in those days. And then my sister was eligible at that time to go to college. And my mother managed to obtain a scholarship for her. I remember how diligently my mother worked to obtain the scholarship. She went around from one person to another trying to promote the idea. In those days, there was what was known as senatorial scholarships. And she got her a full four-year scholarship to state senator. I don't remember who the state senator, the U.S. senator was at that time. But I think it was 1939, and she made the determination to save transportation costs, and she was working in Pittsburgh, that they left McKeesport and moved to Pittsburgh. I stayed on in McKeesport because I was then a senior in high school, and they didn't want to break up my high school experience, so that I stayed on, and then my uncle, the attorney, took over the house that we had all lived in together. He married and kept that house. So I actually went on and lived in the same room that I had always lived for that senior year, and my mother and my sister moved to Oakland in Pittsburgh when they had an apartment at the Ruskin Apartments in Oakland. My sister then went to Pitt. She went there for 4 years. She was a good student, always did very well. I was a good student, grades were, there was no such thing as, I don't remember anybody, I don't know any of my friends, Jewish friends from McKeesport, my age, or my sister's age, who were ever in trouble or ever had any problems of any kind. We were all good students, we all played an instrument of some sort, we all had these kind of Jewish experiences. It was a very wholesome and healthy background. When my when I finished, well, I remember very well that the question came up about my going to college. My sister had a scholarship. She was 4 years ahead of me, so that meant that she would be finishing college about the time I was ready to start. I was eligible. I was a senior in high school in 1939, 1940. I was ready to go to college. And because of my experiences with my sister, who I said was an extremely attractive young woman, men came from all over the tri-state area to date her, including one person by the name of Biggie Goldberg. Does that name mean anything to you? Doesn't mean anything, I'm surprised. Marshall Goldberg was an All-American football player.
Yes, I didn't know who you're talking about, Marshall.
And I remember when he came to McKeesport to pick her up, all the people on my street gathered around and stood outside when he came to pick her up.
What did you call him? Not
Biggie was his nickname.
Yeah.
And Biggie was, there were a group of Jewish fellows, one of whom was a well-known Pittsburgher and became a friend of mine later years, Lester Hamburg. And they would come as a group, and they were all Pitt students, and they all belonged to a certain fraternity, Phi Epsilon Pi. And I remember that through them I met others who would come to my house who were from Penn State. And it was because I had a very special affiliation for that group from Penn State, that I wanted to go to Penn State. It's interesting how you make these decisions, what influences you and mine. And I remember that my uncle, Philip, who was still living at that time, came to me and said, I want you to know that you are going to go to college, and that we will see to it, the family will see to it, that there's enough money for them. I said to him, you know, I would love to go to Penn State, and I figured out that I could go to Penn State as cheaply as I could go to Pitt, because the tuition at Penn State at that time was, and I may be somewhat inaccurate, but it was about $85 a semester. Whereas the tuition at Pitt, believe it or not, in those years was something like $500 a semester. And I said, the difference I can live on, and I would prefer to go to Penn State. And he and another uncle of mine and my mother got together and decided that that was okay, that I could go to Penn State. Well, that was a wonderful experience. I think that was a great opportunity for me to break out of the mold of the singular experience of living in this area. And that was an opportunity to meet others from other parts of the state particularly, and some people from New York. I became a Phi Ep, that fraternity that I was interested in. I remember going away to Penn State. I remember being rushed, as they say in fraternities, and I sort of always have a recollection that there was a selection process going on. By the way, you didn't even consider joining a fraternity that wasn't a Jewish fraternity. Today, that's not the case. Today, my son went to Hobart and joined a fraternity, which had, I think, five Jews in it. The rest were all not Jewish. I was appalled by that whole concept, but daren't say anything about it. But I remember very well that there was no such consideration. Penn State at that time had three or four Jewish fraternities. They all rushed me, as the saying goes, and my choice from the very beginning was Phi Ep. I became a Phi Ep. Lived in the Phi Epsilon Phi house for my entire time at Penn State, which was until I achieved a Bachelor of Arts degree. I was very active in extracurricular activities and probably had my first real Jewish leadership experience at Penn State. And somebody's going to do it.
let it go.
No, that I never do. Listen to that. I've been doing a lot of them. People sometimes go out and on and in, and her advice, which is reasonably intended, that you're not going to remember to turn it on, I found that not to be true. We do turn it on. In the meantime, stuff like this is...
You want to turn it on?
No, it's too late. I thought that, I didn't realize that's why you're doing it.
Okay.
Well, I don't think
so. Write down where he left off, and you know, it's very interesting because you're just going in the order of these questions.
Oh, really?
Very easy.
Well,
for me.
Sequentially, I guess.
You're doing a very, very organized.
Hi.
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 Good to
Hi.
See you.
Hi. How are you?
Why?
I was just telling. I
you
was
just.
I
need
right
you.
Time.
Do you like a cold drink?
I'm sure I would.
No, thanks.
Howard?
Thank you.